Was it a partisan political attack? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, police say a local man is accused of attacking a group of Republican volunteers in this fraught election year. We'll take a closer look and take your calls at 549-2937. Then later, Culpepper with all of the revved up action at Daytona this week. But first this morning, a local man is under arrest, accused of trying to crash a van into a group of Republican volunteers working to register voters. Police say 27-year-old Gregory Tim rammed his van into a tent of volunteers Sunday at Atlantic and Kernan Boulevards outside the Walmart there. President Trump and a host of other Republican officials across Florida, including here in our city, condemned the incident as a partisan political attack. FSCJ political science professor Daniel Cronrath has some thoughts. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. And to call us up, it's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Okay. We don't know the motivation of this man yet as to why he rammed into this group of folks. They were set up outside the Walmart trying to register voters. These were Republican volunteers. And of course, both parties are working to register voters in Florida pretty hard. Mm-hmm. That said, it was certainly scary for all of the folks that could have been hit by this vehicle, and police are investigating. What are your thoughts about this, first off?
Well, I would say, first off, you know, you're right. This is going to be a very, very important election coming up. And, you know, there are a lot of folks in Florida right now who are registered as no party affiliation. So both parties are working very, very hard and diligently to make sure that folks are properly registered if they want to participate in the primary process. Of course, there's more at stake for the Democrats coming up here in Florida on March 17th than what there is the Republicans with their nominee effectively chosen. But, you know, Melissa, this is an act of violence. And I think this is the first thing that we need to understand. When I saw a lot of the comments that were coming out both locally and nationally from some folks in Republican circles, I was a little taken back because we need to make sure that we understand that this gentleman was acting in a criminal manner. This is not reflective of a larger group of people. You know, this isn't, you know, some sort of exercise in logical fallacy where we have one individual who's acting out and then we're going to take a broad brush and paint all progressives or all Democrats or all liberals living in Florida as radicals. Okay, this gentleman engaged in criminal behavior. He needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We need to understand what his motivations were. But I take great exception, and I would do this with either political party, just to say, oh, you know, we need to double up our efforts and we need to register more people to vote to fight against these radicals. What radicals are we referring to? Criminal behavior? You know, that's criminology. That's using laws in order to prosecute this gentleman. That's not, you know, we don't prosecute people at the ballot box, Melissa. That's, you know, so I think we need to make that distinction.
Thanks for that. And it's certainly reflective of the tension I think many Americans out there are feeling in this divisive time, in an election year, and in particular here in Florida, which is a swing state, where every vote counts, partisans are fired up, and it's only going to get more heated, the rhetoric that you just referred to, as we get closer to Election Day.
Yeah, I think that when you look back and you know, go through a little bit of political history, we've had other times in our country's founding in which we've been very, very divided. We've had, you know, deep partisan roots going back to the origins of our political parties post the passage of the Constitution. We know, most folks are aware, you know, the framers even spoke at length about the dangers of factions. George Washington, in his final farewell to the country in his last speech, which he gave as president, warned us about the dangers of becoming so deeply divided. So what's different now? It's technology. It's our use with social media. It's the fact that, you know, we have the ability now to reach out and immediately touch folks. We have the ability to find people who can reiterate how we feel and literally magnify our feelings quickly. And sadly, again, you know, you in a country now, I think, Melissa, we have 330 million people. It only takes one or two, and I hate to use this expression, but it's appropriate. It only takes one or two bad actors or one or two folks who are disturbed in some way to really, really paint with a broad brush again, you know, what is political violence versus what is somebody who's just violent and somebody who is engaging in criminal activity.
Someone just sent me a tweet from Senator Marco Rubio. He said on Twitter just this morning, the Duval Democratic Party has set the example. He's referring to the local Dems condemning this attack, as well as the local Republicans. And then Rubio goes on to say, the current level of anger and division in our politics is way too high. Both sides have voices portraying fellow Americans as a dangerous enemy. We are playing with fire.
Those are the comments from the senator?
From Senator Rubio,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And I think that the tone that needs to be set, and hopefully this would also be applied in reverse, is I think that, you know, some of the comments which came out from Daniel Henry, the chair of the Duval County Democratic Party, where he depoliticized it and he basically condemned the actions of this individual as criminal behavior, not to be condoned ever, where you would put human beings in danger when they're just trying to exercise their ability to register people to vote and participate in the political process. That's the tone. I think that when we began to, you know, engage again in overgeneralization, to use it as political ammunition to suggest that all people are bad, or this entire, flip it around, if we were to suggest that all people who support this president are, you know, if you're a Democrat, that all people who are supporters of President Trump are violent or something along those lines. Well, of course, that's not the case. You know, sometimes it's just exemplified by the worst actors in that particular group.
Let's go to a few calls. Chuck is at the beaches. Chuck, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. This gentleman was obviously trying to cause some issues, and there have always been people who could cause issues if they knew who you voted for or how you voted. And I wish you would please help me understand, and I'm hoping I'm wrong, but it looks like if you voted in the Iowa caucus, you could not vote in private. Everybody on the planet would know who you voted
for. Right, that's how they do it there. Or, well, yeah, until maybe after this year, maybe no more. But, yeah, that they have a unique way of doing it.
If I vote in Florida, it's nobody's business. I don't even have to tell my wife who I voted for. In 1960, if you lived in Mississippi and you were a freedom rider and you voted, they could hold that. People would hold that against you. So how in the world on the planet do people in Iowa think that you can't vote in private? Am I wrong? Do they have to vote in the primary and everybody on the planet know who they voted for?
Yeah, that's their system, Chuck, and thanks for the call. Of course, the Iowa caucus melted down, and it, for all we know, they may not even have a high-profile Iowa caucus next presidential election. It was such a disaster. But yeah, you caucus publicly. You go and stand in a room with the candidate that you are supporting.
Right. It's very important to note, Chuck, too, to answer your question, that, you know, the political parties in all of these states set the rules for how they're going to be selecting their nominee. That's why you're going to find deviations in all 50 states regarding what you even need to do to qualify for the ballot. This process, as Melissa said, you know, being unique to Iowa, it's high participation. But just imagine for a second, you know, you're living in Iowa and you want to exercise your right to go out and choose who your Republican or your Democratic nominee is going to be to represent your party, to run for the highest office in the land. And you have to stand in a room with your uncle, your neighbor, your dry cleaner, you know, whoever the case may be. And you basically have to, you know, attest in public.
This is who I'm voting for.
This is who I'm voting for. And imagine, you know, just imagine you're in a situation like that. And, you know, not everybody is an outgoing personality. What if you're just somebody who's more introverted? And that whole idea of being able to have one person, one vote is compromised by the fact that as Chuck said, you don't want to have everybody who lives on your street knowing how you feel about politics and about who your candidate is.
And we're in a climate now where I think he was trying to get at this, where people avoid this topic with their neighbors or their family members or their coworkers because they don't want it to lead to an angry confrontation of some kind. If they feel that the person across from them disagrees.
Right. I think that's one of the most negative things which right now is going on in our culture, is that we've been taught over the last generation that we're not supposed to talk about politics. And in reality, we should be talking about politics. It's the most important. Like, we will gladly get into a heated conversation if you're a Florida Gator fan with a Georgia Bulldog and talk about, you know, what the history is between your rivalry and everything like that. And at the end, you walk away and you're like, oh, wow, yeah, dog fan's crazy, or whatever the case may be. We don't do that with our politics anymore. And we should, because that's really the most important thing we should be talking about in a civil discourse, in a way that we're all Americans, we're all Floridians, we can all be friendly. You know, we can disagree.
We can agree to disagree.
And without being disagreeable.
WJCT, right. The Times Union, One Jacks, and other organizations have been promoting a civility initiative around this city for years now. And I just wanted to reiterate that it is very important. Rusty is in Arlington. Hi, Rusty. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I, first of all, I want to preface what I'm about to say is I do not agree with the young man running into the crowd, whether it be Democratic or Republican. Like you said, that is an unlawful act, and he threatened people's lives. But I believe I can see where he's coming from. We're talking about a 20-something whose social skills probably are not that great to begin with because of living life online. And now we have a president like Donald Trump who says nasty things, does nasty things, is divisive. His goal is to fracture the country. And some people can't handle Donald Trump. I mean, I'm 63 years old, and sometimes I feel like I'm about to lose my mind with the crap this man does. He is a danger to the country, and some people can't cope with that. And I believe that's what happened to that young man. It's just the pressures get too great when you have a traitor in the White House. And I know a lot of people don't like to hear me say that, but I feel that it's true.
Okay, Rusty. For voters that agree with him, how much responsibility does this president bear for the divisiveness, the anger, the edging close to violence, some other incidents that have happened in recent years? And of course, in Charlottesville, a white nationalist actually did run over and kill a woman.
If you are willing to give this president the benefit of the doubt and say that individuals are responsible for their own behavior, the one thing that you cannot say is that this president has gone out of his way to try to discourage this kind of talk and this kind of environment we have. When you have a president who at campaign rallies will literally say, get people out of there, I will hire you an attorney if you commit violence, telling law enforcement officers not to be so nice when they're putting suspects into the back of a police car, implying that, you know, they're violent. Words matter. And at the end of the day, I mean, do I personally hold anybody responsible for the activities of another person? No. However, this president has really not followed the historical example of leadership, of being our first citizen, of condoning acts of any kind of violence, whether they be an act like this young man with his van or political violence of any kind. And he has to bear some responsibility for that.
Here's an email from Marilyn. During the Iraq War, we protested every week at the plaza in St. Augustine. We never stood too close to the curb because there were times when cars would deliberately drive too close to demonstrate their disagreement with us. Here's a comment, though, on our Facebook page from Pete. This is an inexcusable act of violence. In this political year, it should be national news. We're getting other emails from folks saying that there's a double standard, Daniel, that if a conservative had rammed a group of Democratic volunteers, the national media would cover it and cover it and cover it. What do you think about that?
I think that this event has gotten a lot of coverage over our national media.
And we're covering it locally. The best we can to cover all the news.
Yeah, so I just want to say that. It did get a lot of coverage. I would find that unfortunate. And again, I think that regardless of your political party, that we need to discourage acts of violence. And, you know, going back to one of the comments about your previous caller, too, and we don't know what the motivations were yet of this young man. We haven't delved into it. But it's amazing, too, that when you looked at his profile, he also fits the profile of the young white man who we see being the perpetrator of mass violence in the country right now with guns. This young man, for whatever reason, decided to weaponize his vehicle. So,
Europe, they are seeing that time and time again. Young, disaffected men weaponizing their vehicles, ramming into crowds. This is a phenomenon in other countries, too.
Right. So, you know, for me, and again, this is not my area of expertise, but, you know, I would love to, you know, as time goes on and we learn more about this young man, you know, what markers would he potentially share with some of those other folks that we see out there right now in our mass shooting culture? What were the motivating factors that led this young man to do it? And then back to your original question, and I think to answer a little bit more completely, you know, do I fault the President of the United States for this gentleman's actions? No. But let's be clear. The President of the United States could come out very, very aggressively in the very the next day and rather tweeting them to be careful because law enforcement's coming and we know who you are and whatever his tweet was, it's language like that. Just flat out condemn the act. You know, tell everybody, regardless of your partisan affiliations, this is not a country of violence. We do not do this. As the caller said when she was protesting the Iraq war, you know, we do not drive too close to the curb because we want to potentially put innocent people who are expressing their First Amendment rights to assemble and speech in danger simply because they don't agree with us politically. It should be condemned. It should be condemned by you and I, Melissa. It should be condemned by the president. It should be condemned by everybody.
As we talked about a minute ago, Senator Rubio tweeted that when you start to demonize millions of people who you disagree with as enemies of the state, we are on dangerous ground if we lose sight of the fact that we are all Americans.
Listen, when you talk about losing our liberties, and when you talk about political violence, and when you talk about losing control over your government and your country, most throughout history, most people did not realize when their democracy was slipping away from them. So I don't think it's an overreaction to say, to support the senator's comments in this regard and say, listen, you know, every single time there's an erosion of our liberties, or somebody commits an act of violence to suppress somebody from having their own political thought, that puts us all in danger, period. And we need to resoundly say, regardless of whatever their partisan stripe is, that we're going to condemn it.
Thank you for that. He's Daniel Cronrath of FSCJ. Always great to have your insights.
Thanks, Melissa.
In a moment, how Jacksonville is celebrating the Black National Anthem this month. It was penned by a local man. We'll be right back.
Like many historic parts of Jacksonville, Springfield is changing fast. Join WJCT and the Jackson for a neighborhood walking tour on Saturday, February 29th. Exploring Springfield's past, imagining its future, is led by the Jackson's Ennis Davis. Tickets are limited for this guided tour. Get yours now at wjct.org/events and see you on Main Street.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. That's Beyonce. Did you catch her in 2018 at Coachella? She thrilled fans, especially those here in Jacksonville, when she decided to incorporate into her act, Lift Every Voice and Sing. It's also known as the Black National Anthem. And there's an important local connection to that song. A coalition here is celebrating the 120th anniversary of Lift Every Voice and Sing. It was written by Jacksonville natives James Weldon Johnson and John Rosamond Johnson. That's just one of their many achievements, by the way, and events are planned in town all through this week to mark the anniversary during Black History Month. Here with more, we welcome former state senator and co-chair for this series of events, Tony Hill. Tony, good to see you. Good morning.
Good to see you, too.
And Monique Tooks. She's Director of Family Empowerment at Potter's House International Ministries. Good morning, Monique.
Good morning.
I almost said mysteries. what are your thoughts about the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing? Did you know it was written by James Weldon Johnson, who hailed from Jacksonville? You may even have a kid that goes to that school, and you didn't even know this. Give us a call at 549-2937 as we talk about the 120th anniversary of the Black National Anthem. Tony Hill, let's start with you. Tell us more about how James Weldon Johnson and his brother, John Rosamond Johnson, wrote this song and why it came to be so significant for African Americans.
Well, first of all, the two brothers were from Jacksonville, Florida, grew up here in Jacksonville, and they wanted to do a celebration around Abraham Lincoln's birthday, which is February the 12th. And so they gathered 500 kids. First, it started off as a poem. And then the brother, I guess they were sitting on the porch at home on Lee Street, which is here in Jacksonville, and they began to put it to music. And that's where Roseman comes in, John Roseman Johnson. But anyway, they performed this song with anticipation of Booker T. Washington coming to town. Uh-huh. And they performed it there at Stanton High School. And the rest is history. It's an iconic song that is still being sung all over the country, all over the world. And what's interesting is it's not a song that you would identify as with African Americans, because nothing in there talks about slavery. Nothing in there talks about African Americans. It just talks about a struggle of a people. And it's been sung in Japanese, Spanish, French. And so the Johnson brothers really brought national recognition here to Jacksonville, Florida. And a lot of people today think that he was born, he was from Atlanta, Georgia, because he went to Atlanta University. Some people think that he was from New York because he was big in the Harlem Renaissance. And some people even think he's from Nashville, Tennessee, because he taught on the faculty at Pitt University.
But he was from Jacksonville.
But he was born and raised here in Jacksonville.
And you have been instrumental in, really, honestly, getting this city to do a better job of honoring not only James Weldon Johnson, but other towering figures who hailed from here, African-Americans who played a monumentally big role in the civil rights struggle, in fighting Jim Crow laws. Jacksonville is finally sort of coming around to recognizing that we are home to these influential figures, right?
Well, we're showing our true diversity here in the city. When we think about the Johnson brothers, we think about A. Philip Randolph, we think about Augusta Savage right next door in Clay County. It's interesting, Melissa, that all these people were able to influence the Harlem Renaissance in New York, and they came from right here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. So it's a true saying, as I was telling Monique, that it's not where you're from, it's where you're going.
It's where you're going.
Because we're all from somewhere.
That's right. So all this week, Monique, Jacksonville will celebrate James Weldon Johnson and the Black National Anthem, beginning with a big, there've already been some events, but there's a few coming up this week, including the unveiling of a new mural at James Weldon Johnson Middle School tomorrow, right?
That's right, tomorrow at 6. And that is going to be amazing to have a mural that capitalizes the amazing contributor to not only music, not only to education, civil rights activism, but to have the mural and the children can see it every day. Not only just his image, but the words of that song. And I love the way you put it about, it's about a struggle. It's not just about a certain, it's everybody can relate to a struggle. And so, and even as those kids walk the hallways and they look at those words, whatever they're going through at James Weldon Johnson Middle School, which is a college preparatory middle school, they can be encouraged that they can overcome whatever the obstacle. And so that's at 6 o'clock. And then we also have the same day at Bethel Baptist Institutional Church, the choir will perform the song at the Jacksonville City Council. That is going to be amazing. And that will be at the Chamber Council floor. Wednesday, there will be an inaugural event, a celebration of 120 years of lifting our voices, and that will take place at the Ritz Theater Museum. If you really want to know about the rich history of Jacksonville, particularly in the African-American community, please visit. And that's open to the public, but the museum is impeccable.
Yeah.
Another thing, which is another historical event, and we're so excited about it, is the inaugural event called the Heritage Bowl, which is a baseball game that will be held at A. Philip Randolph Field
Jumbo.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. The Jumbo Field. Forgive me. The Jumbo Field. And that will be played by the William M. Raines High School Vikings, and they will play Joan Rebaugh High School Trojans.
Oh, very
That's
nice.
That's going to be Trojans. Amazing.
So that little Raines-Rebaugh rivalry is alive and well.
Yes. Okay. Healthy, yes.
And so this is Thursday, the baseball game, and it is located at 301 A. Philip Randolph Boulevard. Of course, A. Philip Randolph was the guy who put together the entire March on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. The main way you know he's from Jacksonville these days is that you might occasionally drive down A. Philip Randolph Boulevard. So he at least has a street named after him. But Tony Hill, in addition to this week, you've been involved in efforts to have James Weldon Johnson be recognized in a more permanent way, haven't you? In the La Villa area of downtown, there are efforts underway to create a whole statue and a park honoring James Weldon Johnson. Can you tell us a little more about that, too?
Well, first of all, we want to thank the city of Jacksonville for taking on the project in our parks and recreation. We are now in the emperor's stages of putting together a park designed with the Johnson brothers. A statue with the piano, with them playing the song. So we're looking forward, maybe in the next year or two, of the city with the mayor, Curry, and also the city council members, Scott Wilson and that group coming together to provide funds to build a state-of-the-art, an iconic park in memory of the Johnson brothers, because once we do this, people are going to come from, this is tourist dollars coming in.
Yes.
I mean, this is major tourist dollars coming into the city because of his, not only the song, but his brevity of background. Melissa, he was a diplomat, an ambassador to two countries, mm-hmm. Venezuela and Nicaragua, mm-hmm. James Weldon Johnson. Not only that, he was the first African-American executive director of the NAACP, which adopted this song as the opening of every convention. In fact, we have letters where they sent out to the faith community to sing the song on Sunday, yesterday. We asked every church, and I want to shout out to Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church, who has been instrumental with the Jacksonville Youth Choir of having a program around Lift Every Voice and Sing every year. And so we had churches from all over, the AMEs, the Baptists, the United Methodists, where he was really instrumental. His mom and them attended Ebenezer Baptist Church, which is over on the north side in the Sherwood Forest area. Mm. So when we think about the first African-American to pass the Florida bar.
Yeah. His achievements are so long, we could just go on and on, right? Yes. I mean, he was really extraordinary. And so this park then is mm-hmm. part of a wider effort to make Jacksonville more of a tourist destination by creating a heritage trail of important civil rights era figures and sites, correct?
Yes. That's right.
That's been going on for a while.
Yeah.
Can you bring us up to date on are there other places, other landmarks where people will be able to go and take a look and learn more?
Well, of course, as Monique just said, tomorrow night is going to be an iconic moment because we're going to have a mural, not only of the Johnson brothers, but the song where the kids can go past that. In fact, Melissa, that is the official song of the school mm-hmm. at James Weldon Johnson, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And so we have that. And then, of course, the Heritage Trail that we talked about with A. Philip Randolph, with other people from the community, that Zora Neale Hurston at one time, the great poet, she lived here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Where, of course, we can talk about Ray Charles when he was at the School for the Deaf and Blind in St. Augustine would come over here. And so the list just goes on. Even Langston Hughes spent time here in Jacksonville.
I didn't know that. And see, there's so much people don't know.
It's a lot of folks that have contributed When we think about Clara White and the Clara White mission and the contributions that Sister White made to this city and the recognition that was brought to Jacksonville. But this week, we're centering in on the Johnson brothers. And we like to call them JJ.
So again, Monique, lots of events happening. If you can catch one of them, you should. Beginning with the unveiling of the mural Tuesday night at James Weldon Johnson School. The performance at the Ritz Wednesday night and the baseball game Thursday night.
Right, right. And the Wednesday event, all events are open to the public. Mm-hmm. But you asked a question that I thought was very interesting. I think if you are a native of Jacksonville or even a transplant, if you really want to know the rich heritage that we are afforded, please visit the Ritz Theater Museum. I mean, all of the history that Mr. Hill is talking about is laid out. This is an international museum. There are actual local artists who have work showing in Africa right as we speak. And so notoriety, international. So it's Black history should be everybody's history, because in a time where narrative is very important, everybody needs to know, what part did we play? Because collectively, from a synergetic effort, we have somewhere to go. And so that's why I'm excited, going back to the mural, that our children, whoever has, and whoever's listening right now, that you have a student at James Weldon Johnson, you are in a place, an incubator to be great. You're already great, but you can operate in greatness because so many have done it before you.
That's right. And so we are going to honor Mr. Johnson one more time with another rendition of Lift Every Voice and Sing as we go to break. Thank you so much, Tony Hill. He is co-chairing this event and series of events, former state senator, and Monique Tookes with Potter's House. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicings rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Now I'm gonna sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Said I'm gonna sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. I'm gonna sing a song, yeah. I'm gonna lift my voice.
Well, the Broadway hit Waitress debuts tonight at the Thrasher Horn Center in Orange Park. Brought to life by a groundbreaking all-female creative team, this hilarious hit features original music and lyrics by 7-time Grammy nominee Sarah Bareilles. It's all about Jenna, a waitress and an expert pie maker who dreams of a way out of her small town and rocky marriage. We spoke with cast member Kennedy Salters, who plays Becky in the show.
Our show's very unique in the sense of this is one of the, well, really like the only one out there right now where the three like primary leads are all women. And the show just circles around their lives and the power of friendship and the power of love. And you get to see like the fun dynamics between them, which also brings a lot of comedy. Sarah Bareilles, who actually just won a Grammy, go Sarah, she wrote our music and our lyrics for it. So it has a really catchy sounds, like beautiful harmonies. It's just an all-in-all, like, beautiful show.
That's Waitress debuts tonight at the Thrasher Horn Center. Tickets at thcenter.org. Well, here's another live theater option for you this week, and you can really wine and dine your sweetie with this one. That's right. Valentine's Day is Friday, and a modern-day adaptation of the classic Cyrano de Bergerac story is on a local stage. It's The Food of Love, presented by Phase 8 Theater Company. Right now, we're welcoming playwright Kelby Siddons and star Theo Canty. He plays Chris in the show, right?
Good morning, yeah.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, guys, good morning. Kelby, let's start with you. You wrote this as a modern adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac's classic tale.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I've always loved the Cyrano story where you have two suitors trying to woo Roxanne, and the one is without the looks and the other is without the words. Mm-hmm. In our version, we have a modern take on that where you have a Cyrano Alex, who's not sure whether Roxy's going to return her affections. And so she is using a handsome gentleman for wooing, and he is using Alex, who is a chef, for her cooking skills. So instead of wooing with poetry, we're wooing with food. So just like Waitress, it's an intersection of food and theater, and the food is really a character in this one.
So this is immersive. It's not, people that have gone to the Alhambra Dinner Theater, they eat, then they see the show.
Right.
This is a little different.
This is different. So we've used the traditional five-act structure, and we've created five-course meal that goes with that. So each act is accompanied by a particular meal that Roxanne enjoys, and we enjoy the same thing that she does while the action is unfolding.
That is pretty cool. Okay, Theo, tell me about the part you play in the show.
Yeah, so I play Chris, who is the, I guess you would call him the antagonist or somewhat like that. He really likes Roxanne. He meets her, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but he meets her at a bakery and he instantly falls for her. And he tries to talk to her, but he just can't get the words out. Mm-hmm. And he gets some friendly suggestion from one of the workers that there, and things kind of go from there. So you kind of see what he has to do.
Okay. And this was, by the way, staged before, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm,
and
yes.
It was such a hit that you guys decided to do it again.
Yeah, so this is the really awesome part. We're doing this again for the second, this will be our third show, but the mm-hmm. second time this year for Valentine's Day, which makes it great for a little romance, a little rom-com, as you will. Mm-hmm. I am fortunate to do this for the first time. My predecessor is not playing this role this time. He had to go off and do some other things, but I'm really excited about the different spin we're taking on it.
There's a little bit of a different spin. It's very romantic, just in time for Valentine's Day. A great option for a date, to bring a date to.
Absolutely.
This week, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the 13th and the 14th. So you can also grab your Galentine's on mm-hmm. Thursday and enjoy the food, the wine. There's a fabulous dessert. You will leave full in so many ways, full of belly laughs and full of really delicious food from the Mocha Nola Cafe.
Yeah, this is being done at the stage at Mocha, the Museum of Contemporary Art, Jacksonville. Now, let me also ask you, Valentine's Day is also the anniversary of the updating of the city's human rights ordinance.
Yes.
How does that factor into this show?
Sure. Well, so when I was adapting Cyrano, Cyrano's insecurity historically is that he has a huge nose. And I thought to myself, we're living in the age of the rhinoplasty. This just doesn't work anymore for a modern adaptation. There needs to be something essential about our hero that is preventing them from making that leap and reaching out and saying, hey, Roxanne, do you want to get with me? So in our version, Alex is a woman who's not sure whether her feelings are going to be reciprocated by this beautiful woman. Who she has loved from afar for a really long time. So we have an optimistic love story that embraces that heroine. So it's a really inclusive love story for the anniversary of that HRO.
Okay. And is this how you staged it the last time too?
Yes. Yes.
And what was the reaction then?
Oh, we got great reviews. I was on such a high afterwards as a playwright. It felt so good. So we have the actors actually walking around. Our fabulous actor who plays the lead, Stephanie Santiago, describes your food before you eat it, which I swear just makes it taste so much better. We should always have someone announce what you're going to eat and exactly how it's going to taste, because it was an incredible experience.
I'm going to read the menu now just to whet everybody's appetite. And by the way, they do have vegan and vegetarian options available. But here's the main menu. Avocado toast with goat cheese. Okay, you've got me right there.
Right? Yes. That's one of my key trigger words.
I gotta have my I'm a white mom, okay? Yes. Give me the avocado
toast. Every day.
Yes, all the time.
Prosciutto wrapped asparagus with hollandaise sauce, grilled watermelon feta and pine nut salad with a citrus chipotle vinaigrette, beef bourguignon. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Bread pudding with lemon and blueberry and red or white wine. Wow. Okay, so if you're intrigued, you need to get your tickets now, right, Theo? Because you guys can only accommodate 40 patrons a night. It's a small group.
Intimate. Small, intimate group. So it's going to be really fun, very interactive. Mm-hmm. I'd say get your tickets today.
Yeah, definitely.
Really?
Yep, phase8.org.
It'll sell out that quick. You guys are good.
Yeah. We've been on sale for a while. So yeah, we actually did a lot of sales already in December and January. So now's the time. Commit to those plans.
And, you know, I've been to productions at the Mocha Theater. Mm-hmm. It's a really neat place to go see a show because it's one of the smallest, most intimate little theaters in mm-hmm. town.
Yeah.
And it's just a different experience I think people will like.
And we're actually in the cafe. So we even have the actors walking around you as you're being
served.
Oh,
you do it in the cafe.
Yeah,
so you don't do it in the theater.
You start to smell the food cooking at times in the plot where the food is starting to get mentioned. It's a really amazing experience. Yeah.
So you don't really have a stage per se.
No, yeah.
You're just acting mm-hmm. in the middle of the dining room.
Yeah. So we have a little corner of the dining room that would be more like a stage, but then the action also wanders around you, just like the aromas of the food. It is very sensual experience.
What's it like to act that way?
It's very different in the sense that every night is different, right? Because you get a different crowd, people position their chairs differently. So you have to be ready to just be in the space and kind of experience things as they come to you. But it's really awesome because you do have that really real feeling of the food cooking while you're acting. So it mm-hmm. gets really nice that way.
How are the acoustics in there for you to project your stage voice through that room?
So we will be mic'd.
You're mic'd.
Yeah. So we'll have that extra boost of sound there. But it's just a brilliant space and a really well-written play.
Mm-hmm. Well, kudos to you guys. This is such a great local production to check out. Phase 8 Theater Company is reprising their sold-out extended run of a theatrical Valentine's Feast adapted from the classic tale of Cyrano de Bergerac. It's The Food of Love this week only, February 13th and 14th, 7 to 9 p.m. at Mocha Jacksonville. Your ticket includes dinner, wine, and the show. Get your tickets now at phase8.org. That's phase, P-H-A-S-E. EIGHT.org to get your tickets. For Valentine's Day, there isn't a more romantic ticket in town. So kudos to our playwright, Kelby Siddons, and Theo Canty, also involved with Phase 8. He's starring in the show. Break a leg. Have fun.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bon appetit.
Bon appetit. That's right. Okay. That's, again, this Thursday and Friday. But you know what else is going on? It's Daytona 500 week. After the break, Culpepper will join us with a look at all the action and some other sports news and notes. We'll be right back.
Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good. The Women's Board of Wolfson Children's Hospital presents the Florida Forum Speaker Series. The series continues with Hall of Fame wide receiver and three-time Super Bowl champion Jerry Rice on February 25th. Tickets are available at floridaforum.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Pollan, who's written best-selling books about the origins of the food we eat and how psychedelics are helping scientists understand consciousness and the brain. He has a new audiobook about caffeine, its effect on the mind and body. As usual, he immersed himself in his research, quitting coffee cold turkey. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Fred Rogers of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is a cultural icon. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll explore Fred Rogers' enduring ties to Florida and Rollins College. We'll discuss newspaper coverage of the Patriot War and the impact of sea level rise in historic St. Augustine. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
How deep is the split within the Democratic Party? After Iowa and the president's impeachment acquittal, the split between progressives and moderates could sink the party in November. Is Democratic desire to beat President Trump strong enough to persuade both camps to unite for the fight ahead? I'm Todd Zwillick. That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd. Award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program, will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information.
Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Welcome back. It's Daytona 500 week in Northeast Florida, and Culpepper is here to help us get all revved up for it. She's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? Okay, the front roll was set yesterday down at Daytona. Cole says, hey, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. turned in the fastest speed of the day, 194.582 miles an hour.
Wow.
That's specific.
Yeah.
He'll be on the pole Sunday for the Daytona 500 with Alex Bowman joining him on the front row. The rest of the field will all be set on Thursday with the twin duels that will run in the evening. Sunday's race will be the 62nd running of the Great American Race.
Wow.
It's something that has certainly become a staple of American sports and staple of our sports calendar in Northeast Florida as well. And we'll talk about this here in just a bit, but it is a part of a very busy early spring portion of the calendar now. But all of it pales in comparison to the fervor that was kicked up last week, Melissa, when we talked about the Jaguars' plan to move two games to London.
Sure.
On Wednesday, I was back in here to talk about it. And since then, there has been even more of a development. The Bold City Brigade, the largest organized fan group in town, banded together and launched the Duval Coalition, which includes a number of local businesses and other fan groups and mass numbers of fans.
And didn't the website crash? It was so popular.
The website, yeah, they have a website where, you know, according to the website, again, we haven't seen a full list and a roster, but the website is claiming over 20,000 Jaguars fans and over 700 local businesses represented, well over 20,000 season tickets that are up for renewal, in opposition to the Jaguars' plan to play two games in London in 2020. So we talked with the Jaguars president, Mark Lamping, about this, and it sounded, while he says he is going to meet with the Duval Coalition, doesn't much sound like it's going to change the Jaguars' plans.
What it does is it underlines the passion of our fans. And, as I said, we're anxious to connect with that group. We talk to fans all the time, and the results will be judged at some point well into the future. And the actions that we take really have a long-term view. And that long-term view is something that I think all Jaguar fans will agree. You know, we want a strong, successful NFL team here in Jacksonville for generations to come.
By the way, the owner of the Jaguars can decide whether it's going to be in Jacksonville for years to come.
Sure.
It's entirely up to him. So part of this, of course, is a little bit of a concern that, well, maybe they would try to move the Jaguars to London in the future. Here's where I am on this whole thing. I think it's terrible that the Jaguars are taking another game away from the fans in this city. This whole thing about needing to be out of the bottom quartile in revenue doesn't matter to fans. The only two things that really matter to fans are what, Melissa?
Are they winning?
Winning, number one.
Sure.
And two, is the game day experience good enough? In other words, when you go to the stadium, if you're down there, whether it's your tailgating or the concessions or the halftime show or whatever.
Are they getting their money's worth?
Is it a value?
Yeah.
Are they getting enough payback for the money they're putting down? Aside from that, it's all gravy. So let's just say the Jaguars are not being moved to London. It's not that the Jaguars haven't spent money on players in the past. Andrew Norwell, Nick Foles, Dante Moncrief, Niles Paul, some of these recent free agent additions who have been, well, at best, average. You have to sign the right guys. In the NFL, the only thing that the TV money doesn't cover for player costs is signing bonuses. That's really a function of cash flow. Do you think that Shad Khan has a cash flow issue?
Right. I mean, from the fans' perspective, it looks as though Shad Khan just is trying to make a little more money off the backs of these long-suffering fans and that he's just not listening to the fan base.
Or that at this point, the way that the Jaguars have performed on the field is not going to grow the fan base locally anymore until they start winning. So shy of that, you can go over to London and get a bigger payday. There's no doubt about that. It's not really off the backs of the Jaguars fans financially because most of the people who are going to that game in London are not Jaguars fans in Northeast Florida.
Sure, but he's taking these fans for granted is the point I'm making. They feel dissed. They feel disrespected.
Yeah, and not heard, I think, is maybe the biggest thing here, Melissa. You know, this is all about trying to make more money from the football team so they can have some free cash flow to build a new stadium in a few years. I mean, that's really what this boils down to. And they want that new stadium so then they can make more money with the team. And I'm not against making more money, but a professional sports team in your city is more than just another business. It means more. There's more of an emotional connection. It is, in some regards, a public trust. And as in any business, you have to respect your customers. And I think that's where the Jaguars brass is missing the point right now. We'll see how it's going to approach coming up.
Yeah.
We do want to look forward, though, to a couple of events. We talked about the busy calendar, starting with the Daytona 500. We're less than a month away from the Gate River Run on March the 7th. And then the following week, the Players' Championship begins. So we are in a stretch here where there's going to be a lot going on. Yesterday, by the way, they ran the 26.2 with Donna, sort of the prelude in some regards to the Gate River Run in terms of the running calendar in Jacksonville. A 13th year for that, and we'll be keeping a close eye on how the top runners are performing as we cover the Gate River Run on Channel 4 coming up on March the 7th.
Always catch Cole on Channel 4 every night and on our air every Monday morning. Thank you, Cole.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you for listening, everybody. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. You can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8, and we will connect with you again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.